Odyssey is giving you a chance to win a trip to London to see Taylor Swift at the Eras Tour. It's Tay in the UK.
Hey, it's Taylor.
Just download the free Odyssey app, log in and listen to a participating station for a minimum of 60 minutes to get your daily entry. And you could win a chance to fly off to London with three friends and see Taylor.
I can't wait to see you at the Eras Tour in London.
For more, go to odyssey.com/Taylor. Tay in the UK.
It's on the Odyssey app.
Thanks to Republic Records.
This is a national contest.
From 2400 Sports, Odyssey, and Major League Baseball, this is the PBP Voices of Baseball.
We bring you the people who bring you the game.
Welcome in. It is season two of our little podcast, the PBP. For play-by-play, the PBP Voices of the Game is what we call it. Sometimes we say it fast, like PBP, and people don't know what we're saying, so I'm going to say it slower. PBP. I'm Matt Spiegel. I talk to baseball play-by-play announcers. If you're just checking us out, finding us anew, well, welcome to the returners. Thanks for coming back for season two. For all of you, here's the deal. Baseball does not exist in our ears until the person describing it says it does. These broadcasters have a tremendous impact on the experience. That's why they work so hard on the craft. We talk to them here. We get stories, insight, perspective, and relive some of the most memorable plays they've ever called. Me, Matt, I do it sometimes too. Here in the middle of a long broadcasting career, I've gotten to do an inning on Cubs radio five or six times a year over the past few years. And last year when Pat Hughes went into the Hall of Fame, I did a full series on the radio. Cubs Cardinals at Wrigley, I went 3-0. Thank you very much. So as I dive in to learning about it, I'm also trying to be decent at it. Seems like a neat parallel track to interview the best broadcasters we have doing games and to bring those conversations to you. Brian Anderson, he may be in your head from his tremendous work during the NCAA tournament on CBS and TNT. He may be known to you via his excellent regular season work and playoff series with the NBA on TNT, but he's also the primary television voice for the Milwaukee Brewers, and he's probably my favorite postseason broadcaster in baseball. Don't tell other friends of the show who've been on the show. Keep that low. But Brian Anderson does tremendous work through the LCS every year on Turner Broadcasting. I look forward to getting the chance to hear Brian Anderson more when the playoffs come, in fact. And that's where we started. Enjoy BA.
Joe Buck was the first guest on this show last year, and he's become a friend. And we've talked so many times about the national audience hating him because he's not the local guy who they've hung out with all year long. And I got to tell you, have you felt any of that the way that Joe has felt it and some others have? Because baseball's so provincial and we spend so much time with our locals, and all of a sudden there you are parachuted into their world.
Yeah, I nobody feels it like Joe does because he was on such a big stage for so long. But, you know, I have the benefit of working for the local, the Brewers, the local team, and working for the national. So I kind of get both sides of it. But yes, it's usually East Coast driven, I'd say. This has been my small sample case study over the years. It's the Phillies, the Bostons, the New Yorks, even Atlanta. Atlanta, actually, their fan base is probably the most, they got the biggest teeth, let's just say. So you hear from it, especially when things aren't going their way, but that's all part of it. And, you know, I do a disclaimer every year. I used to do it on Twitter and now X. I do it on Instagram now because I got off Twitter. But my disclaimer was, you know, I'm not rooting against your team. I'm just celebrating success. And if your team happens to be the team that the success is happening against, you're probably going to not like that. So I highly recommend you go listen to your local radio announcer. You'll have a much more friendly experience there. So that's kind of my disclaimer every year. But
it's a good
it's
one.
All in fun. I'm glad that people care.
Yeah, right? The passion is what it's about. All right, so let me ask you this, and you tell me if you buy the premise even. I feel like a great play-by-play person, especially in baseball, has to be both a technician at the craft itself mm-hmm. and an entertainer. And I'm wondering where you are on that scale. Like, people come at this from different angles based on their origin story, their broadcast experience, all of that. Where did you start on that scale? And has that shifted a bit for you as you've done the job for these years?
That's a good question. And I'm, you know, that's one of the things that I talk about when I talk to young announcers. And I I teach a workshop, a 2-day workshop every year at Marquette University. And there's a couple of areas that I like to go into that I never heard when I was coming up and nobody ever addressed. A lot of it was technical. There's a lot of technical discussion, how to do this, how to get to A to B to C in your broadcasting. And all that's really important. And I use a lot of those templates to this day, that mental structure or outline. And then you can be as creative as you want inside the template. You know, it all depends on how your brain works, but that's how my brain works. But what I will say about the entertainer part, I see, because I listen to hundreds of demo links a year, and I just see a lot of young broadcasters trying to be interesting, trying to be entertaining, trying to come up with catchphrases and things like that. And so for me, I never did that. And my recommendation is, number one, instead of trying to be interesting, just try to be interested. So replace the ing with the ed, and that's all you'll ever need in this business. Because if you're interested, and what we do as play-by-play announcers, not only are we delivering the historical verbal presentation of it as we watch these events unfold, but we're also trying to bring stories to life, or trying to tell stories about players, coaches, managers, fans, whatever it may be. So if you're interested in all of that, that's going to drive everything you do. So instead of trying to be an entertainer, I don't consider myself an entertainer. You know, Bob Uecker is an entertainer. But when he's doing a baseball broadcast, I think he's hilarious and he entertains, but only because he asks great questions and he's curious about people and always talking to players. And he delivers all this great material because he's genuinely interested long before he even gets on the air. And that's something that I've tried to just use as a motto my entire career and what I try to share, because I don't want young broadcasters or any broadcaster to feel like they've got to go entertain and do a comedic monologue or anything of that nature. That's pre-planned. That it usually doesn't work, especially in baseball broadcasting. Mm-hmm. So it's really important to let the river go where it wants to go, and you not put the dams up in the river by trying to be entertaining. That's really an important part of the puzzle for me. And so as long as you're staying interested in when you're on the air, how the game's coming to you before you go on the air, and all your prep materials, how you sit down with all your work, how you go to the ballpark with all the players and staff and subjects that you're trying to engage with, those are all the really important pieces. So that's my advice.
It's good advice. And, you know, the question itself coming from me sort of belies where I come from, because I'm a talk show host who's getting to dabble and try to learn play-by-play these last 4 or 5 years is a lifelong dream. And I've got to hold in some of that talk show host. But whatever it is, like, you know the game. You've been broadcasting for years, so you're learning all the game. But you were also a catcher. You're a college catcher. And I know your brother's a scout. I mean, you know the game. Do you make a conscious choice sometimes not to analyze when you could analyze, to make sure that you're letting your partners do their job as an analyst?
Yeah, 100%. I feel like I know things that, first of all, I don't claim knowledge very often. So there are things that you intrinsically know just because of my athletic background or my college baseball background, but I didn't play professional baseball. I certainly never sniffed the major league. So that's an area that I can only tee up for my analyst or tee up when I'm trying to find out about a certain style or what works when I'm talking to players. But, you know, for me, again, it goes back to being interested and not trying to be interesting. I just try not to own that. I just try to either quote it or ask a question or ponder an idea. And of course, the analyst, you know, there are things now. I've been working with Bill Schroeder for 18 years. Like, I can finish his sentences and he can finish mine, and I know how he sees the game, and he knows how I see the game. So there is some performance art to it, but at the same time, it's better delivered from him. There's a rhythm to the show, the broadcast. There's a rhythm to it as well, that in television, more so than radio, is really important, that, you know, it's not just me driving this play-by-play bus. When you're on television, it's, you've got an analyst, you've got a sideline reporter, you have a producer, a director, all the graphics folks, the EVS, the tape machines, like everybody's dropping their pieces into this stew. And if you're not, if you're just doing your thing, you're going to, you know, you're going to leave them all behind or to the side. So for me, it's constantly trying to serve, trying to point guard, and set up all these different scenarios and look ahead to these different scenarios, whether I'm working with Ron Darling or Jeff Francoeur or both in a three-man booth, or whether I'm working with Bill Schroeder or Vinny Rotino or Tim Diller with the Brewers. For me, it's always about the analyst first. What is the analyst thinking? What's on your mind in the commercials, in the before the game, when we sit and I just call it like the riff period, where we're just making our notes and we're sitting in the booth and it's quiet. Hey, what's on your mind? What are you thinking about this guy? And we're just talking back and forth. So as much as I can know, the better I can lead. Oftentimes in television, if my analyst will make a point, I may hit the talk back while he's talking and hit the producer. Hey, he's talking about so-and-so, Willie Adames at shortstop, making these plays. And maybe the producer can bring up a tape rip of a couple of those plays that he's talking about. So for me, it works in this big circle, round and round it goes. And if I'm always taking the mentality of A, being interested, but also serving, if I'm constantly serving the audience, my partner, the truck, the production truck, then it's going to be a much better broadcast. I could commandeer it at any point, and it would be very comfortable for me to just take over, say whatever I want, see whatever I want to see, talk about whatever I want to talk about. And that would be a great experience for me, but it wouldn't be a great experience for anybody else, because it's not it's a collaborative effort. And, you know, I liken it to a band. You know, if you could go and start ripping guitar solos all day long, but that's, you know, you're out of time, and the drummer's like, what are we doing? The singer doesn't know when to come in, the bass player. So all of that is kind of the way I've always viewed this job, especially making the conversion from radio to television.
That's, I mean, any listener to this show will be giggling to themselves that you just brought up the band analogy, because I'm a singer and a band leader. And like, I make that analogy all the time for broadcasters, but also for ball clubs, because as you described it, that serving the game, serving the broadcast, making sure that is the star as a teammate. That's what a great model you're having. You're showing as both a leader and a teammate, and working it all around for everybody. I don't think I ever knew you were a college catcher. I don't think I've ever heard you mention it. And that's part of it. Why would you bring it up? It's not relevant. If anything, it could feel competitive to Schroeder or a catcher or anybody you're sitting next to. Right. You don't want to lessen them in any way.
No, and I don't feel like it has any value at all, other than, I do think like an athlete, and I understand the athletic mind, because I lived that life, and that was my sole purpose until my junior year in college, when I realized I wasn't going to be good enough and I had to panic and find another job.
Can I jump in there? Because you finding another job as a junior in college gets us to the origin story, which is unbelievable. So you transfer from one school to another. The one you end up transferring to is St. Mary's in San Antonio, right? So Brian Anderson is a catcher at St. Mary's. And oh, by the way, the Spurs just happened to be training there.
Yes.
And the story as I read it is you decide to go watch Spurs practice one day. And you end up doing what? Take me from that day that you decided to go watch.
Good. You've done your homework, Matt. Well done. yeah, my path is very unorthodox. So I was extremely focused on playing, and I wasn't good enough to be a Division One player. My brother at this time, my brother Mike, at this moment that we're talking about, is very instrumental. So I don't want to leave his story out and part of it, because it is a huge part of why I did this. But
yeah, scouting legend Chuck Lamar gets in there. Like, I know that stuff too. So I know it's all mixed in the soup, right?
Yeah, so Chuck Lamar signed my brother out of a tryout camp. My brother Mike goes on, and he ends up making it to the major leagues in 1993. So this is 1992. He's kind of pushing double A, triple A. Prior to that, every summer, I would go spend usually a month, sometimes 6 weeks with him, and I would train, I would hit, and because I'm still a player at this point. And during the games, Mike was a starting pitcher. So, you know, he didn't play every day, but when it was his day to pitch, I would go up in the radio booth to these minor league ballparks. So guys like Kurt Bloom and Larry Ward and Howard Kelman and all these minor league radio announcers were very kind to let me up there in the booth with them, especially Kurt Bloom, who put me on the air for the first time in Birmingham, by the way. That's another story. So anyway, that had kind of been my background. So I've seen all this, and I'm kind of like, ooh, I like this broadcasting thing. And I felt like, you know, I could do that and wanted to do that if my playing career didn't work out. But now I'm back in player mode, and my college is, we're the number one team in the nation in NAIA. So we're a small college, but a very, like a powerhouse. And I'm the catcher. I'm the starting catcher on the number one team of the nation. So back before they have practice facilities for NBA teams, the NBA teams would go around to local colleges, and that's where their training camp was. And this particular year, when I arrived on campus after I transferred, was St. Mary's. And so, like, I love playing pickup basketball, and I played all the time, and I still do. We were going in there to get a run in, and all of a sudden, like, there's David Robinson and Antoine Carr and all these. I'm like, what's going on here? And they go, well, the Spurs are training here. So I was, first of all, dumbfounded that that could even happen at my college. So I just sat there in the stands. Long story short, now met a guy who was still the director of broadcasting there. At that time, he was just getting in his job. His name is Mike Kikarillo. We struck up a friendship. I've got all my baseball gear on. He plays in an over 30 league. He wants hitting lessons. I go give him hitting lessons. He's like, oh, why don't you be my intern? So this is a very fast way to tell the story, but basically through baseball and through my playing career, this guy, Mike Kikarillo, became one of my best friends and mentors. And that really started a path for me into broadcasting. And he was always the one saying, you know, you could do this. Like, you could do this. You have the passion. And during this time, like all through high school, even in college, I would always call play-by-play, not because I thought I was going to be a play-by-play announcer, but I would just do it as a bit in the dugout when I would, you know, when it wasn't my turn at bat or I didn't catch second game of doubleheaders. So I would be in the dugout and I would just start calling play-by-play, and everybody would sit around me like, that's pretty good. And so,
you know what, that Pat Hughes, our friend Pat Hughes, as a bench player in college basketball, he started doing the games, and his teammates were like, you know, you're pretty good at that.
Yeah.
So same kind of vibe.
I did the same thing, and I even took it, you know, in the non-conference kind of schedule. There was this one umpire, and when he was the first base umpire, he was an earshot of me calling play-by-play, and he loved it. He just, I don't know why. His name was Mike, and Mike just loved hearing that. And so when he would be behind the plate, and I was catching, he go, give me some play-by-play, man. Give me some play-by-play. So I would actually do it. And then, you know, it was a funny bit, weird thing. But because now, okay, the Spurs do their thing, I get involved with Spurs broadcasting. More on a technical side, though, I was a handheld cameraman. I did audio, graphics.
See, that's fascinating. I know. So tell me all the technical jobs you had, because your friend Mike was director of broadcasting, or at least ended up that. So you did a whole bunch of technical roles, and are you doing play-by-play while you're doing the tech, like just to yourself? Are you quietly doing play-by-play while you're wrapping cables and plugging stuff in?
Yeah, in sports. So you got to remember, like, this, when I start work, so I'm going to college, I'm playing baseball, I'm doing an internship with the Spurs, and then I start in the summer, the next summer, I got this job at the local cable company. So my technical background had nothing to do with sports. Like, because I'm sitting here at this cable company doing all the, you know, all the public access stuff that you see, like all the cooking shows, you know, the Vietnamese cooking show. I'm the one setting up the mics, switching it, directing, one-man band, you know, it's public access. And we were doing talent shows. And like, I always tell the story, you know, the famous Selena, the singer, the Tejano artist who was murdered. I did her last concert. I did handheld for her final concert at the Alamo Dome before she was killed. So we were doing music festivals like that, like Selena. We were traveling around San Antonio. So it had nothing to do with sports. So I was learning how to do handheld camera. I was a lot of audio stuff, a ton of graphics. And at the time, part of knowing Mike Ciccarillo was you can be my intern. That doesn't pay. What does pay is the Jumbotron camera operator. So I'm like, well, I can do that, even though I had never put a camera on my shoulder ever, but I went and trained and I learned fast, and I ended up sitting on the floor doing handheld for Spurs games. And that's where I started doing play-by-play for this very small in-house productions crew. So I would open up my key, you know, the camera's on this side, on the right side, the mic's on the left side, and, you know, we can communicate with the guy who's directing the in-house production. Well, I would open up my key. Usually keep your key off so you don't want all the noise of the arena. But I would open it up and they would ask me to do play-by-play. So, yes, that's true what you're asking. But I didn't do that for a while because I was doing everything else. I was doing music festivals and, you know, public access and cooking shows. And these wild conspiracy theorists had their own shows. And so that's kind of where my technical background started, at this place called Paragon Cable, which became Time Warner. And that was, we were all doing everything. And some of those guys I worked with are still camera operators to this day with the Spurs and in that region in San Antonio. So just fast forward, like all these technical jobs end up sustaining me as I graduate from college, played out my eligibility. We went to the NAIA World Series in Des Moines, and it was a great career for me. I knew I wasn't good enough. Well, now I've graduated and I have an English degree. So it's not like I was even a journalism major. So now I don't even know how this is going to work. So I got the minor league baseball job that, you know,
the missions in San Antonio
with that team. Yep. Mm-hmm. And so another stroke of luck of me transferring to St. Mary's, not only did the Spurs train there, but we leased our field to the Dodgers at the time. That was their double A team. So I got hired to do that mainly because of my technical background, because I knew we were moving into a new stadium in 1994. And I knew how to rig all this stuff and set up all the audio paths and patches and the whole patch panels. And I just had a really sound technical background to kind of help usher them into what at the time was a newer age of how they were going to present their games. They didn't have a video board, but they did a lot of audio stuff and a lot of PA stuff. So anyway, that's kind of why they hired me, and they wanted me to help with the broadcast. So I did, and I ended up doing three innings a game, and I clocked in with the ushers that first year. And I threw batting practice, and I caught bullpen. So again, I'm just coming off the field.
You caught bullpen. Yeah, come on, man. This is the best stuff. This is so life affirming and career affirming, because especially as we get older, you realize that everything you've done is kind of part and parcel of the work you still do, right? You sit in a baseball booth now, you know the technical aspects, so you can think more empathetically to those coworkers. If something comes up about, you know, Selena in conversation because Ron Darling saw, you've got knowledge, right? And baseball allows for all of your experience and knowledge to get in there because of the pace. You know what I mean? Does that make sense? It's all in the soup for what you bring to a broadcast.
Right. And it's just, I think the lesson in all that is, and nobody's going to have my path. Like, that's just the most unusual, strangest path you could have. But for me, you know, it wasn't like I calculated all this. I'm going to go do all this technical stuff. That's going to bounce me into a play-by-play job. but I'm also going to throw batting practice and be part of the team and have a locker in the coach's office and catch bullpens because that'll help me. It was all just saying yes. And yes. The Dodgers were saying, we don't have enough batting practice pitchers. We'll pay you $25 a game if you'll throw BP. And I'm like, sign me up. We'll also pay you $25 to catch bullpens because nobody wants to do that. So, you know, Bert Hooten was the pitching coach. So Bert Hooten, once I caught the first, so I caught, this is a true story, Matt. This is like the one that blows people away. Chan Ho Park's first bullpen in the United States at AA. I caught. And the first 20 throws, and you can ask Bert Hooten this. First of all, he was wearing red underwear under his white pants, which was distracting to start with. And he threw a softball the first 20 pitches. And I mean, and he was throwing a softball like 85 miles an hour, a big softball.
Why is he throwing a softball? Was that a training thing?
It was a training thing for him. And I could barely catch it in my glove because, you know, my catcher's mitt, I'm just wearing these off the face mask. And anyway, so then he switches to a baseball. And back then he threw straight over the top. And he is, I mean, he's bringing it. I mean, he was mid-90s plus. And I have a mask on and a cup. I have no shin guards. I thought this was a light bullpen. He is blowing right now. And I'm just picking everything, wearing them on the shins. And Bert Hooten goes, oh, hell, you could catch for us right now. So I'm here thinking I'm going to get signed based on this performance. Anyway, that's what I did. So I pulled back. So listen, it was all survival. I made $25 a game to be a play-by-play announcer. I clocked in with the ushers. The Dodgers paid me $25 a day to throw BP, and they gave me $1 a bag on the road. So when we would travel, when the bus would pull up, I would pull all the bags out so the trainer didn't have to, and he would sit there with a wad of cash, and he would count the bags, and there was usually between 60 and 68 bags, I think it was. And he would pay me $1 a bag. And I would say, I'd tell him, don't touch the bags. And I would pull every bag off the bus, set them on the carts to deliver to the rooms and all that. So that, but I did all that because I needed the money. You know, I was out of college. I had a wife. I was married right out of college, you know, and I was trying to make it. And, you know, I didn't come from money. So we weren't, it's not like I had a big bank account. So I was in total survival mode. Same way with the technical stuff. Amazing. Everything that came up, can you do this? Can you do the C-SPAN convention? Absolutely. Done a million of them. You know, I'm up there with Paul Harvey, miking up Paul Harvey.
And now you know the rest of the story.
And that's how my story ends, with just saying yes and not being, you know, I guess looking back on it, not being so ego-driven. So I always say, like, because a lot of my friends went to Newhouse at Syracuse, and I always say, if I'd have went to Newhouse, I wouldn't have done any of this stuff. I would have been too above it. I would have been elitist, you know, because I wouldn't have just said yes to all
Brian, I've talked to tons of people, tons of broadcasters. I'm thinking about, I mean, my nephew's 26, and he works with Howard Kelman in Indianapolis.
Oh, wow.
That they're partners.
You'll know my
together.
Brother.
Yeah. Okay, good. Well, they're going to be... I think I'm going to do them together as a guest on this pod. You got the young up and comer and the minor league lifer next to each other, which is a fascinating dynamic in and of itself. But yeah, I've talked to a ton of those Newhouse grads about what they did, and they, most of them were fortunate enough to have a different path. You know, whoever it is, Joe Davis starting with, you know, Montgomery Biscuits and working it out there and then rising to where he is at this age. It's like, your unique path, I think, is going to be instructive for a lot of young broadcasters who.
Yeah, to each his own, too. I don't knock those guys.
No judgment. No judgment.
I wouldn't have lasted 5 minutes in the Newhouse school, first of all, just so you know. Like, I freely admit that. I wouldn't have lasted. I would have never. I wasn't good enough. I wasn't even thinking that way in college. You know, I wasn't even thinking about being a broadcaster. I just, you know, I'd seen so many games in my life, played in them, watched them. Watch my brother go to a professional level. When I hit the ground, it wasn't now the shift comes to more of the technical stuff, because when I started doing games, it wasn't the rhythm of the game that was the issue. It was my voice and my just, you know, I had a kind of a Texas draw. I kind of talked up here in the register like this, and I was, this is the way everybody in my family talks, man. I just talk like this. So I was kind of like hillbilly mode, and I didn't know that you could strengthen your voice and have breath support. And, you know, I was losing my voice a lot in the first couple of years. I would get loud, and instead of pushing through, my voice would be really high in the register, because I didn't know anything about voice training or anything technical like that. And that's really, you know, for me, it was almost backwards. Like, there's so many kids who have great voices, but no rhythm or feel for the games. I was the opposite. I had great feel and rhythm for the game, but I was impossible to listen to.
Did you work with a dialect coach or anything to get rid of the accent?
No, I got a book, and it's available to your listeners right now. And I've probably sold more books for this guy than anybody on the face of the earth. And I'm telling
you. Let's sell some more.
It is the best book. My agent, so this guy named Steve Herz, who ran this agency out of New York called If Management, he liked me in early days and wanted to sign me. I had a chance to interview with the Padres right away after my first year, and I needed an agent to help represent me. And long story there, but he ended up taking me on, started his own company. I went with him. Same group that has Dave Revson and Dan Schulman and a number of other guys. So anyway, he said, listen, your rhythm is really good, and like your feel for the game, and you're fun to listen to, but your voice, it's just, you're only going to be able to work in Texas or in the South. Because I did have a little bit of a Texas drawl and didn't use it properly. So he gave me this book. It's called Change Your Voice, Change Your Life. And it's by an author named Morty Cooper, Dr. Morton Cooper. Change Your Voice, Change Your Life. You can buy it right now for $12 on Amazon. It's required reading for my class at Marquette. It'll take you 6 hours to read this book, okay? It's tiny. But this guy worked with a bunch of singers in the 80s. Lionel Richie, Stevie Nicks. He was a like prominent LA voice coach. And I just read his book, and that's it, Matt. That's all I did. I read the book.
Wow.
And I go, oh, that makes sense. And I took all those instructions and pieces that he talked about as if I was an athlete trying to fix a slice or trying to, you know, change my mechanics on my swing. I just did exactly that. Just like I was being coached. I took it. I took nothing personal. And from year two to year three was when I literally went from talking like this, hey, everybody, it's Missions Baseball, to basically what I sound like now, only because I unlocked my jaw. I took a big, full diaphragm full of air, let that air pass over the vocal cords. And then all this resonance came out in my voice, and it changed everything. And it literally did change my life. And so now I had the rhythm and I had the mechanics of voice and sitting up straight and all of those things. Now it was just a matter of like doing the games and getting a chance. But look, I spent 9 years in the minor leagues. So this whole idea of like, you know, I mentored Joe Davis and Jason Benetti, and these guys went pretty quick, you know, especially Joe. Like, that wasn't my experience. I got stuck for 9 years in the minor leagues. I couldn't get a job anywhere.
But you self-critiqued and self-learned and found
as an
the
athlete,
book. Yes.
Without being defensive or uptight about it or making it personal.
Boy, I mean, that's everything, right? That's how you learn to be good at anything. And that athlete's mindset helped you as a broadcaster. That's incredible stuff. Tell me a moment from baseball's postseason that you've gotten to do that you loved, that we could go and pull and listen to. So any moment from a baseball postseason where you're like, man, we did that one pretty well as a boomer.
Yeah, that's a scary place for me to go. I'll give Ryan a heads up so you can even pull it up. It's the Delmon Young bases loaded clearing double 2014, I think, Orioles, Baltimore Orioles. And the reason for that is, number one, the Orioles, it was a wild scene at Camden Yards, and it was awesome. So great. It was Tigers Orioles. Tigers had the three aces going. You know, they had the best pitching, you thought, Verlander, Scherzer, Price. But the Orioles were kind of this upstart team. And so in this scene, Delmon Young, a number of things kind of worked in that scene. First of all, I know Delmon Young, and I covered him quite a bit at that time. He's a notorious first ball swinger. And I just know, like, every instinct in my body in this moment when it's hot, he's going to swing at the first pitch. I believe Joaquin Soria was on the mound. And J.J. Hardy's now the runner at first, who is the go-ahead run. Now, J.J. Hardy was an Oriole at this point, but remember, he had been a Brewer. So I know J.J. Hardy. Number one, I wouldn't say reckless on the bases. So, okay, in my mind, he's slow. J.J. Hardy is one of the quickest shortstops with one of the best arms, but one of the slowest players in the major leagues. So I'm already thinking about this. He's at first base. He carries the go-ahead run. Young's going to swing at the first pitch, I think. I'm pretty confident, to the point where I actually said it on the broadcast right before the first pitch. Now, the question is, if he does something other than hit a home run, is J.J. Hardy going to be able to score from first in this small ballpark? This is before all the changes at Camden. So all in my mind, before the first pitch, these are fluttering through. Like again, from an athlete's perspective as a catcher, I'm going through the multiple scenarios very quickly, shuddering through my mind. What to do if the ball's hitting all these different places? So, and that's what I'm doing. So I'm setting all this up, and I'm seeing all this unfold. And, of course, I'm debating whether I should say Delmon Young loves the first pitch here. I don't remember what I said, but it's something like...
And everybody knows he's ready to fire on the first one. Bases loaded. Young swings, line drive. That is down and to the wall. Cruz is in. Pierce is in. Hardy around third. He's going to try to score. And safe. The Orioles have the lead. The legend of Delmon Young in the postseason continues.
Again, back to the original, when we first started talking about what am I interested in now? You're like, what's the most interesting thing that's going to happen in this meeting? What am I interested in happening in this moment? And every Orioles fan, is J.J. Hardy going to be able to score from first base to put him ahead in the eighth inning? When I don't know if he can, because he's so slow. So... people don't know that, though. They don't really know J.J. Hardy. He's not like, I mean, he's a name, but so I know that, though. So immediately I track the ball. Here's the ball. Where is J.J. Hardy? So he's lumbering around. And the other thing, like, this didn't come up, but I was, you know, ready for it. And I can vividly remember thinking about this during that play. J.J. Hardy in 2006 blew up his ankle with Todd Green catching in a collision at the plate, sliding in the home plate. And there is a potential that this moment is going to, and he's had, like, it almost cost him his career. And I know he's thinking about it as he's trying to score. I just know it, because any horrific, traumatic injury like that, it's on his mind. So what is he going to do? Will he slide? Will he run through? Will he head first? Will he barrel him? I don't know. So I just knew this was going to be a drama. So I did, it all just worked out. I called him. I picked up Hardy. Hardy scores. They take the lead. And it was. And then I just laid out. And the place is going crazy. And when all that was finished, nobody knows all the things that I knew about that whole sequence in my own brain. And I didn't share that or whatever. It's probably the first time I've ever told the story, actually. But for me, it was like, son of a bitch. That was, you did it, man. Like, you're on a big stage. I hadn't been doing playoff baseball very long at that point, maybe 5 years. And I was like, wait, just, you trusted your instincts. And now I've trusted my instincts and they've been wrong and I've flamed. But
you got to trust them again the next time, though. You got to trust, you just got to keep trusting them, right?
Yeah. And you just let it fly. I'm like, for me, it's just let it fly and let's see what happens. And in that case, it was kind of the perfect storm of mechanics. Breath support, drilling through that call with the crowd, also laying out, also the setup before of remembering and having a clear mind, which, all right, let me take you back a second. So for me, there was a big stage of my career where I would get so nervous and I would be so uptight that I wasn't thinking straight. So what I would do is it wasn't even a sports thing. It was just a rhythmic breathing thing. And you take these rhythmic breaths, and that puts your heart in rhythm, which allows your brain to think, releases those chemicals, like real mystical stuff. But it's true, and it's how athletes would perform at their best, you know. And I talked to all these guys like Kevin McHale and Robin Yount and all these like world-class athletes about how they got calm, because I was getting really uptight, nervous. I had, you know, I didn't feel like I belonged. I had all this, you know, imposter syndrome when I first got here. So all the mental stuff nobody talks about. Well, right. All of that came together in this one moment.
There's so much wisdom in there about like all the context that you bring to it, and then choosing what you're actually going to share, and then choosing to lay out, which you do beautifully. You know, one of the things we went back and listened to was, I think, you know, one of the most impactful games I've ever been at as a fan was game four, the 2015 NLDS, the Cubs and the Cardinals. And it's the night that the Cubs beat the Cardinals, and they beat the organizational standard of St. Louis, who also happens to be the generational rival. You know, there's that feeling of new, like, are we good? Are we good? As you're looking around the ballpark, I think we might be good. And it's like everything that's going on there. Like, to me, that was a more emotionally resonant series than even like the NLCS the next year against the Dodgers when they beat the World Series. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Did you, as a Brewers guy, feel that connection with the Cubs Cardinals dynamic? Was it in your head at all in that series?
Of course. And this is, you know, for your audience, who, if you're listening to this, obviously you're kind of tuned to the broadcasting side of things, but I cannot stress enough. I am not a fan. I'm not a fan of a particular team, even though I do the Brewers. Like, I love the Brewers. I want the Brewers to do well. Believe me, when I'm doing a Brewers game, I work for the Brewers and I'm doing the Brewers. When I'm doing a Cardinal Cubs playoff game, the Brewers are the last thing on my mind. And I know that's hard for people to understand that, and that's okay. And that's kind of where all the venom comes from.
Right.
But you're literally, it's like the assembly line, and you're in the moment. And of course I'm receiving all of what this means to the Cardinals, to the Brewers. There was a case in 2011, I'm doing the NLCS. Albert Pujols hit a monster home run off Zach Greinke. The Brewers are my team, but I'm doing the NLCS for TBS. I have to jump on this Albert Pujols call because it matters to Albert Pujols and the Cardinals and their fans. And that's basically won the game. It's game six. They end up winning the game and they go on to the World Series and win the World Series. So it's like, there's no way I'm going to be fully in the moment. There's no way I'm going to be downshifting that call because I'm the Brewers announcer in the regular season, nor would I ever.
You can't have Brewers fans in your head while you're making that call.
I'm not even doing that. I don't care about that. Honestly, I'm here to do a job, paid to do a job, and I'm going to be in the moment. And again, back to the celebrating success. So of course, when I'm doing Cubs Cardinals, all of that and all of that drama and all the storylines, the narratives that are in it. And then Kyle Schwarber hits one. I think he hits one on top of the scoreboard, right? It stays up there on the new video wall, and like this crazy moment. What I remember most about that is once the Cubs won that game and advanced, like, we're always worried about the escape route. Like, we're weird that way, announcers. Like, how do we get out of there? Especially at Wrigley, because Wrigley is like the most, it's crazy to go down the ramps and, you know,
serpentine.
If they win, they're happy. If they lose, they're yelling at you. But what was amazing about that, the Cubs win that series. And I can remember like leaving the booth. Now, I got my car in the parking lot because I only live in Milwaukee. So I'm driving home. Nobody's leaving. Eddie Vedder standing down there on the third base dugout. Everybody's in their seats. I just walk right out. I go down the elevator. I go to my car. There's no traffic. I was home in 90 minutes. Greatest getaway ever. Usually it takes 90 minutes to get to the highway at Wrigley. I said, this is amazing. I called all my partner, Ron Darla. I said, hey, I'm already home. So anyway, that's what I remember most. I said, thank God the Cubs won.
That is amazing. That is amazing. We have the final moments of that series, actually, and it's a great example of you laying out.
The 0-1, Carpenter goes, and a swing and a miss. No balls, two strikes. Carpenter ends up at second base.
Do that again, and it's over.
He got him! A strikeout! The Cubs win! The Chicago Cubs are heading to the National League Championship Series!
Yeah. Man, it's a lot when you're sitting with it on a pod, but on TV, we're all bringing our own context to it. We're bringing our own thoughts to it. It doesn't feel like a lot.
Yeah, you don't need an announcer, for sure. And those are conscious decisions. You know, you're, as you sit there and you're, you know, like, your voice is laid on top of this forever, at least for this particular broadcast. And you can, like, there's a menu of things I could go to. I could give the count. I could set the scene. I could, I'm kind of following the director as well there on television, where I'm watching the monitor, whatever his shots are. And I believe the shots he was cutting around were crowd shots. So there's really no, I don't need to say there's a guy and there's a guy and there's a guy. I don't need to do that. I don't need to give the count. I've just given it. I don't need to do any more setup than what's after. So there was no, like, if I was on radio, I wouldn't be able to do that, because you notice that call was in the past tense. It was after the strikeout. It was, I didn't even do any setup. I didn't say he's on the mound, he kicks and fires, here's the pit. You know, I didn't do any of that. So it was just the past tense of the result. And so, you know, my ego says I didn't really technically do a good job play by play wise, but again, when you're in the moment and you're at Wrigley and they've got a chance to do something amazing and that crowd's going crazy, for me, it's just like, oh, let's just sit here and watch this with them.
Yeah, it's awesome. And Eckersley with the do that again and it's over reminds me of something.
And he does it again.
He does it again. He does you it know, again. It's like
Eck was the man. I loved working with him.
Tell us why. Tell us why Eck was Eck so much
was
fun to work
totally
with.
Reactionary. He's a lot like Reggie Miller. And he came with some prep, but he was just totally reactionary. If you'll go back, and you can insert this later, the Kyle Schwarber home run I'm telling you about. Schwarber hit a home run on top of the scoreboard, and Eck said, "What in the world?" as the ball is leaving.
And Schwarber sends one high and deep, way back, and this ball is long gone.
Mercy. What in the world?
And so he had all these phrases and sayings, and he would lean on you and tap you, and he was just completely immersed in the moment. And I love Reggie's the same way. Like, there's a video out there of Stephen Curry's 3-point record where Reggie literally they you know, the booth cam or the table cam shows us calling it, which I don't really like those things, but Reggie is just straight posting me up. Like, he's all over me. He's dropping his shoulder into my shoulder and he's pushing me off my chair. He's not saying anything, but I'm trying to call this thing. And Reggie's literally like, totally in the moment. And, you know, I love that. And Miss Eck doing games. And Frenchie's like that too. Frenchie, Jeff Francoeur, he gets into it. Ronnie's very studious. And, you know, I love them both like brothers. And it's great working with all these different guys, but it is funny, the guys who are just so reactionary and touchy feely, and they want to, they want you to know, they want to talk. And so I'm all for it.
That the partnership is so beautiful. I'm sure there's something you and Schroeder must have a million things too. Like, the play happens, you write down the play and he talks, like, just like sort of little things, like little cues like that to each other.
And where it really shows up the most is when maybe, okay, a perfect example would be, it's scary how connected we are. But an example I give is if I'm reading a promo, okay, and that comes on a card and I'm physically holding a card in front of my face reading, you know, don't forget, April 7th is bat night, whatever. Well, if something happens on the field, Schroeder Rock, we call him, he knows I'm reading this and I'm not looking at the field. Like, I'm not coming up with these promos off the top of my head. So he'll know that. And then if something happens where somebody gets ejected or somebody's jawing, or it's happened a number of times through the years, he knows that. And he'll just instantly step right in very calmly. Well, you know, he's been mouthing to him ever since that last strike call. And I don't know that. I'm going, really? In my mind, like, what happened? So he's great about the, you know, I call it the ham and egg, and, you know, on the golf course where you're ham and egg. And so some things I catch and he'll fill in the, he won't be able to fill in the blanks and vice versa. So that's really what a partnership is. And he's awesome. He's a great guy and he's a great teammate. And I love the guy. And so when you, you know, you have to work hard at relationships because you're with these guys. Like, I've been with Rock 18 years. I've been around and moored my wife every summer. And so it's important before the games, after the games, to foster that relationship and know that he can trust me and I can trust him. And that's what makes a good broadcast, because we are just, we don't talk much outside the broadcast. I mean, we'll text a little, but when we get on the air, it's like we're old buddies again. And we do that on purpose because we don't want to like bury our best material or fodder. So we wait till we get on the air.
That's perfect. That's perfect. Brian Anderson, you've been so generous with your time. I got a couple quickies for you here, okay? What is a specific item that you always have to have with you in the play-by-play booth for a baseball game? Could be a good luck charm or a talisman or
yeah,
anything.
No, good luck charms. I don't go down that road, but I do have a hot cup of hot green tea or a Yeti full of hot green tea with honey every game I ever do. It just... It's probably a little bit of a crutch. Sometimes I don't even drink much of it, but I got to have it there.
Yeah. Okay, that's good. One baseball broadcaster you really admired in your youth?
Milo Hamilton was the guy I kind of patterned myself after. And obviously Vin Scully and, you know, Ernie Harwell was my guy too. I loved listening to Ernie Harwell.
Okay, one baseball broadcaster who you admire now, who you hear and you're like, man, that person's good.
Baseball broadcaster. Yep. Joe Buck's not doing baseball anymore, but I have a huge amount of respect for Joe Buck. I wish he would come back to baseball, but I love a lot of the young guys, Joe Davis. And, you know, I think Dave Fleming in San Francisco, I think mm-hmm. Dan Shulman, you know, they're kind of Boog Shambi.
Yep.
Jason Benetti, Lynn Casper, even, you know, on the radio side, I love all those guys. They're great friends, yep. And I'm a nerd for broadcasting, so I will constantly – they get sick of me always texting them when they're doing college basketball or when I'm watching a game that they're doing. I'm constantly like, man, you sound amazing. You're awesome. You're the best. You make me want to quit, and I mean it. Like, some of these guys make me want to quit because they're so good. So, this kid Corey Provis is going to go from radio to television in Minnesota.
Yeah.
He's excellent. Excellent. So – Those are definitely good for Corey. Top of my mind.
Yeah, good for Corey. Used to be a Cubs guy. Used to be a Cubs pre and post guy here a long ago. What's one part of your game prep you can't ignore that if first pitch is approaching and you haven't done it, you feel a little naked?
Having conversations with subjects, players, managers, coaches. If I haven't done that, I feel naked. Exactly how it's the phrase I use. I feel like I haven't. And that happens sometimes. Sundays, no BP. Everybody's hiding out. You know, nobody wants to talk to the broadcaster. So that happens. But, you know, that's an uncomfortable feeling for me when I can't go to the broadcast and say I spoke with.
Yeah. Well, all right. Well, and the last one I usually ask is the best piece of advice, that you ever got. And it could be something about the doing the job specifically or something about the overall career. And just kind of how you've guided yourself through.
Yeah, it's more of a life philosophy, but it applies to broadcasting, and it's really important. I just had this conversation with John Schriffen, who's taking over for the White Sox, and it's just be where your feet are. You know, the imposter syndrome is a real thing to try to deal with from a mental perspective, but you're placed here for a reason. You know, I believe it's a divine reason. So if not you, who else? Be where your feet are and just try to do your best and try to get better every day. And so if you take that approach, be where your feet are. Don't get too far in front. Don't say, I wish I was here. I should be here or feel entitled to be at a certain place. And don't be the guy who feels like you don't belong in this place. You have gotten this job, whatever it is, for a reason. You've been placed in this space for a reason. Be where your feet are, and then you'll be amazed at how freed up you become.
Enjoyed this very, very much, Brian. Thanks so much for the time.
My pleasure, Matt.
Be where your feet are. That is simple and helpful, isn't it? All we can do is the job we have, no matter what it is. How about that dude? How about Brian Anderson, a college catcher who never feels the need to tell you he was a college catcher because it's not relevant and it might even undermine his analyst. Folks, that is ego control. Frankly, I'm not sure I have the kind of ego control it really takes to do the job the right way. You got to keep reminding yourself that the ball game is the star. Keep yourself in check and let the ball game sing. Focus on the work, life lessons. Next week on the PBP, Voices of Baseball, the great Kevin Brown from the Baltimore Orioles. Yes, there was a notable kerfuffle last season with ownership. We will touch on that. But my goodness, this young man is really, really good, really funny, and a big-time up-and-comer in the industry with a great job for one of the hottest teams in baseball as it stands. My producer on the PBP Voices of Baseball is Ryan Porth. My collaborator is James Vickery. The theme music comes from the great Kurt Morrison of Tributosaurus. Find the PBP Voices of Baseball on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts. The PBP from 2400 Sports, Odyssey, and Major League Baseball.
Odyssey is giving you a chance to win a trip to London to see Taylor Swift at the Eras Tour. It's Tay in the UK.
Hey, it's Taylor.
Just download the free Odyssey app, log in and listen to a participating station for a minimum of 60 minutes to get your daily entry. And you could win a chance to fly off to London with three friends and see Taylor.
I can't wait to see you at the Eras Tour in London.
For more, go to odyssey.com/Taylor.
Tay in the UK.
It's on the Odyssey app. Thanks to Republic Records. This is a national contest.
The PBP, Voices of Baseball. I bring you the people who bring you the game.
Giving you a chance to win a trip to London to see Taylor Swift at the Eras Tour. It's Tay in the UK.
Hey, it's Taylor.
Just download the free Odyssey app, log in and listen to a participating station for a minimum of 60 minutes to get your daily entry. And you could win a chance to fly off to London with three friends and see Taylor.
I can't wait to see you at the Eras Tour in London.
For more, go to odyssey.com/Taylor.
Tay in the UK.
It's on the Odyssey app. Thanks to Republic Records. This is a national contest.